This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 22nd of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're nearing the end of the year and today it's our greatest hits package that, like all best of compilations, has been perfectly timed to massage your eardrums come Christmas time. And all those royalties, we'll be spending them on a Maserati, obviously. On today's look back at the best bits, we offer you the great Tracy Emin.
I love my bed. I love what I've created. I love what it's done for me. I like the fact that it's iconic. I like the fact that it's changed people's perception of art. And the fact that I'm a woman and I've made a piece of seminal art that's so strong within terms of the 20th century.
We impress you with brilliant and saucy old boy George.
Places like France, it just feels like they never kind of got over what I was. And in fact, the other night I was in Milan and this woman came up to me and she went, "Do you really want to hurt me?" And I looked and I was like, "Yeah, I do actually. Is that your opening line?"
Plus, we'll hear from photographer Wolfgang Tillmans, painter Sean Scully, pianist Chili Gonzalez, ideas man John Hegarty, some Cambodian punks, bearish jazz giant Gregory Porter, documentary genius Errol Morris, the Green Man Festival, a handwriting expert, and a beer guru while enjoying live Midori House tracks from funky Nick Waterhouse and the soulful Asaf Avidan. Chill out, it's all on this show. Which show? This special best of culture with me, Robert Bounds, here on Monocle 24. We'll kick things off with some live music, naturally. This year we've rocked, we've rolled, we've had our heartstrings tugged, and our spines have shivered aplenty from hearing some rather brilliant live music sessions here on Culture. But no session has managed to get the toes of Midori House a-tapping quite like that of San Francisco's Nick Waterhouse, accompanied by probably the coolest band on the West Coast and some super sparkly bongos. Nick really got the party started. So why would we begin with anyone else?
Well, you get to carry a tune, or they put you in the dead room.
Put you in the dead room.
I can't get away too soon. Put me in the dead room.
Put you in the dead room.
Nick Waterhouse, you're a smart man.
I would say so.
You've got a nipped in trouser.
That's true.
You've got a decent leather shoe on with a leather sole.
Shell cordovan, yeah.
Yeah. What happens if someone were to turn up? If a dude were to turn up to one of your gigs, would you regard him with an air of haughty disdain? Would you try and get him to dance, maybe put on a better pair of shoes next time?
I was raised in a community of dudes, so I've learned to speak their language. I I come bearing only an olive branch of rhythm.
That's okay, that's good. I'd like for a second to turn it back to the record.
Sure.
Holly came out last month. Holly sounds gorgeous, but who is she?
I just wrote a record about somebody, you know, that doesn't exist. It's like, to me, I feel like as I worked on it, I recognized that I was maybe writing a piece of fiction. I had started picturing the artwork, the cover, which is the portrait of the girl, early on. I wanted to kind of depict in a way that subverted maybe the cultural touchstones of what I liked. Like in the 60s, you would buy like a jazz record cover and it'd have a beautiful girl on it. Yeah. And it was always very superficial. And I thought, like, what if I wrote about the interior life of that girl? And
because Holly, you're the subject of your album cover, is a beautiful girl, but she's not a doll.
Yeah, she's not a doll. I wanted her to look like the real young women that I knew in Los Angeles. There's a specific type. It's not a cliche, but it's just this kind of girl that I know, that I'm, you know, that I'm friends with, that friends of mine are involved with, that have like always been around, and I felt like nobody had really depicted her. I wanted to make like a cross between, say, like Madame Bovary and like a contemporary Echo Park, you know, hipster, you know.
Wow, that I like.
Yeah.
That's quite a girl.
Yeah, and yeah. I thought that would make for interesting listening. And don't ask me why. I didn't think that consciously. I think unconsciously I arrived at that.
We'll be right back. That was Nick Waterhouse with Dead Room, performed for us earlier this year. We'll be playing more live music from some of our favourite sessions a little later on. This is the best of culture from 2014 on Monocle 24, and we'll begin in the art world. This year we've been all over the place, from an exhibition in Farnborough's wind tunnels here in the UK to art fairs in the likes of New Delhi, Stockholm and Dakar. We've looked at Sydney's public art, explored the Guggenheim's interactive map, and even met a guerrilla art group who decorated the Serbian culture minister's office. That's a fair amount of paintings, sculptures and installations to take in, but what about the people behind them, the artists? I've been lucky enough to speak to some of the masters this year on culture, a few of which we'll hear from now. First up, Tracy Emin. The sale of her iconic 1998 work My Bed was well documented this summer, as it sold for a cool £2.2 million at Christie's. Ahead of the auction, I spoke to Tracy Emin about making the bed.
In some levels, I said it's like a ghost of my past, an old me that doesn't exist anymore. It's just like a fragment or an ether just floating by. And another part of me, just I look at it and I think, God, could I have really lived like that? Could it really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it. But today I had to actually get in the bed and pull the covers up and fluff them all up. So that was kind of weird and eerie and awkward. And something did just go through me. I was thinking, wow, 16 years ago, all of this was for real. Now it is for real, but as an artwork.
Obviously, it's been much discussed, but I suppose, would you call it a simple self-portrait? Or maybe not a simple self-portrait, but clearly it was a sign of your times back then.
Yeah, I think a self-portrait is one of the best ways to explain, for people who can't understand it, to say a self-portrait. You can, when you look at it, you actually can have a good idea of what this woman's like, or how she lived, or what she was thinking, or what she was going through. A self-portrait doesn't always just have to be, you know, what you look like. It can be an imprint of who you are.
And at the time, it obviously created a stir. That's a nice thing to do, to rake up all these discussions that it obviously did as a work of art. Were you surprised by that? Or did you know, like a songwriter when they write a hit single, that everyone was going to be tapping their foot to it 20 years from now?
No, obviously I didn't, because when I showed it in Japan, it was the Dirty Slippers that they made a fuss over. When I showed it in New York, they said, oh, it's like feminist art. We've seen it all before. So when I showed it the Tate, I wasn't expecting to have what did happen. I wasn't expecting that during the Turner show at all, Turner Prize. So it did come as a shock to me. And originally, for the Turner Prize, I wanted to show my beach hut. I wanted a square sculpture in the middle of the space that people could walk round and look at the drawings, and I couldn't get my beach hut back from San Francisco in time. So I went, oh, well, I suppose I'll have to show the bed.
Serendipity shines.
Yeah, definitely. That bed's done me a lot of favours, and that's the other thing. I'm sort of like hoping to help it on its way now.
That was Tracy Emin speaking to me back in episode 142. Another arty highlight was chatting with German photographer Wolfgang Tillmans about his monograph, which was released earlier this year by Feiden. It includes a range of his work, from candid and personal portraits of friends, nightlife and stolen moments, to a series of studies of Concord, the moon and solar eclipses, to manipulations of photographic paper in a darkroom without even using a camera at all. Each word Wolfgang spoke was as wonderfully considered as his photography, so here he is again, telling me all about his life in pictures.
The funny thing is that I can usually trace back most things to my very, very, very early beginnings. I think the big transition happened for me when I was 18 and discovered a laser photocopier, the very first laser copier. And I realized that it could make beautiful translations of photographs into black and white halftone pictures. Mm-hmm. And I was just totally fascinated by the act of an industrial sheet of paper worth tenth of a penny going into a machine at the press of a button and coming out as this wonderfully charged object. How does that transformation happen? How does meaning get into paper? And that I find so much more touching than when I saw my hands gestures on paint, on canvas or drawings.
I love the Concord series of pictures. And they're such unusual pictures of Concord, as I know you know, but most people would take some sort of aircraft pornographic pictures. You know.
yours are so strange. I want to ask, I very simply want to ask you, why do they look the way they do? There's something enigmatic and beautiful about the way that you shot that startling piece of engineering, piece of art in itself, perhaps. But was that serendipity that dictated and luck that dictated how those pictures were? Or was that, were you thinking a lot that day as well?
The Concorde series is something that I thought about a long time. And that's a great thing in photography. You know, you can put a lot of thought into something for years sometimes, and then it actually only takes a very short time to realize the pictures, because that's the great quality of this medium. So I had noticed for many years that whenever I saw Concorde in the sky, it felt like a special moment. And so it did for many other people I talked to. And we could project our fantasies and hopes of a better future into this object. And I was interested in this democratic idea of this sort of childlike awe that it caused in people, and connected to this idea of a better future. I was not interested in the idea of exclusiveness. You know, I was interested in the democratic power of Concorde. Of course, it needs some millionaires to fly it in order for it to be in the skies. So I didn't contact BA or Heathrow to have special access. I didn't tell them about this at all. I just looked at the timetable and the flight path, and I just went to different positions in South London and stood like a little boy, or like a plane spotter for that matter, and, you know, kept looking, and each time, is it Concorde or is it not? Is it Concorde or is it not? And then, well, it's your point of view that makes the picture, I guess.
That was photographer Wolfgang Tillmans, and to round off this recap of some of my favourite art guests this year, we're revisiting abstract painter Sean Scully. His signature blocks of paint, thick and tangible, like bird's eye views of fields of colour, have earned him a place in art history and high prices too. Before a retrospective of his work at Shanghai Himalayas Museum in China, he spoke to me at the Timothy Taylor Gallery in London.
Philip Dodd told me that black in China, for example, is the colour of heaven. And I always thought that white was the colour of heaven. And there you have, right there with just that one example, you have the world turned upside down, because it's not only about the colour of heaven, is it? And it's all the inferences of good and evil, darkness and light and so forth. And the way that all our Western value systems are played out is based on the idea of heaven really being white. Now, when you think that the idea of heaven is black, which used to be my idea of hell or something that frightened me, it becomes fascinating. And I'd like to make a huge black basalt sculpture that's called Heaven Cubed. I'm really obsessed by that now.
Can you do it in time for the show?
No, I can't do it in time for the show. Actually, it was planned to be in the show. And I gave him the dimensions. He told me how much it was going to be, which was a fortune. I said, yeah, that's all right. I'll make it anyway, because I want to make it. And then they said that the floor in the museum couldn't take it. So then I thought to myself, I know. Maybe I'll ask the Turbine Hall if they want to show it. And they'll probably give me the same answer, that the floor won't take it.
And I like that. I like that when extreme practicality comes into the realm of art, as it so often does. And I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Maybe this is a good point to maybe talk about some of that, some of the craft and tradesmanship rather than artistry in it. That's a facet. And I get that in the way that your work is so layered, that physically the paint upon paint, the edges upon edges. Maybe when people talk about art, they forget the tradesmanship and the craftsmanship in it. Is that something that you're interested in?
Yeah, very much so. And I always love the idea that Daniel Day-Lewis makes shoes.
Yeah.
He makes shoes for other actors to stand in. And I think that's very beautiful, because it's humble. So you've got to do something humble to occasionally reach something that's maybe exalted. So I would say it's 95% drudgery, or dishwashing, or vacuum cleaning, or however you want to talk about it. In my case, it's paint mixing. And 5% wonderment.
That was Sean Scully, who looks and sounds and actually is a black belt in karate. Watch out, art lovers. For those just joining us, this is a special edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, a magical compendium of the best bits from the show over the past year. Now, we've had some big voices on the programme. Singers such as the almighty Esker have wowed Midori House crowds with vocal performances nothing short of wondrous. Last month, we invited in Israeli musician Asaf Avidan, who simply blew us away, and you'll hear why now. Hold on to your hats, here's Asaf singing Left Behind.
I just like warm audiences. And I say that, it sounds kind of obvious, but there's just specific places, like every time I play in Paris, every time I play in Hamburg, every time I play in Rome. My point is that it just has to do with some kind of dialogue happening in the show. I hate monologues. I hate just coming and doing my show and just feeling like this sterile environment. Anywhere, doesn't matter what the venue looks like or where it is, but just having some feedback and then eye feedback, you know, it's this, there's some magic that happens. I know it's cliche, but when an audience, there's this Leonard Cohen concert that I once saw on video where he stops, it's the 70s, you could get away with that. But he stops the show in the middle and says, listen, it's not working, take your money back. And he just walks off the stage because he doesn't feel that.
Right.
So I'm not that extreme, but I do love when it does happen.
Well, it's one of those things, I guess the audience has responsibility, like the performer, to, it is a bit of a dialogue, isn't it? To kind of not behave themselves, but maybe almost the opposite, to really get into it, to not be too polite. Is that what you want?
It is my job to get them there, but this tour is a bit weird. It's called the Back to Basics Tour, and it's an acoustic tour, and it's me sitting down. Usually,
just doing a number of Irish ballads.
Exactly.
On a rocking chair.
Exactly. Okay. There's some. Oh, God. I can hear that in my head. It's a very intimate, very therapeutic little thing that I do, and it's all seated venues, usually opera houses or like kind of concert halls. So of course people are polite. It's not the, you know, people don't dance and people don't cheer so much, and so it's kind of a weird experience coming from a rock and roll background. I'm getting used to that, but even so, there's some places where even that show just brings something that is bigger than just my music, and it's bigger than, you know, those people who paid a babysitter and parking and got in there, and just something together, everybody together happens, and it's beautiful.
I'm alive, and like a moth in the night. Oh, baby, I'm coming back home. Man, it's hard to believe, but there's nobody leaving. Please don't lock the door.
That was Asaf Avidan. Hear the entire incredible session on episode 160, which, like all our programmes ever made, is available to download from iTunes or monocle.com. After the break, punk music in Cambodia, a piano lesson in London, and one of advertising's most creative minds. It's a winding cultural road. Do try to keep up.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. from industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said that's ridiculous, that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're taking a look back at our favourite moments from the last year. In this part of the show, we're hitting the shuffle button and seeing where it takes us. Well, we've landed in August, and while the rest of the UK were basking in the sun, yes, it does happen sometimes, I headed indoors to get a little cooler. Chilly Gonzalez is the classically trained piano virtuoso who's collaborated with every hip-hop star and pop diva that's taken his fancy. This year, he released a book for lapsed piano players such as myself called Reintroduction Etudes. But the book wasn't quite enough for me, so I headed to Camden's Roundhouse for a lesson with the man himself.
We are, and this is the first episode of... Sharing a Stool.
I think it's such a good title. We could do this on any kind of genre. Piano lessons, maybe someone that, you know, has lapsed in being trained as an astronaut, anything. Sharing a Stool, I think, can run and run. But where are we going to take it first?
Okay. What kind of music do you like?
I probably like rock music the best.
The piano is a great rock instrument. For example, Jerry Lee Lewis, one of the first real punk rockers and arguably the first person to kind of abuse his instrument as a kind of political statement. I think before Jimi Hendrix did some of his more theatrical violation of the guitar's dignity, there was Jerry Lee Lewis. And I guess Jerry Lee Lewis did a lot with very, very little. He used something called the blues scale. And this is something that you hear a lot in that kind of boogie-woogie music. The thing about the blues scale is it's really easy to find because almost every single note in the blues scale is a black note. So play me now the five black notes.
So what do we got here?
Exactly. Now that's called the pentatonic scale. And you hear there's a lot of great melodies that have been written in the pentatonic scale already, you know? And it's great for heavy metal, right? This is only the black keys. Now, you can just do a big swipe with your hand on just the black keys. There you go. See?
Perfect. The butterflies are subsiding. I've got a bit of power going on, a bit of fire in the belly now.
Yeah, see, that's how you end the piece. So you already know how the piece is going to end. With a big flourish like that, as if the harpist in the orchestra was going blah, 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 and just like ending that piece on a resounding triumphal note, you know. So I think that's, you've got the ending, which is sometimes the most stressful part of what to do when you play the piano. But it's interesting that you can divide up the octave, which is the distance between this and this. There's 12 notes, but different cultures have different numbers of scale. They divide it up differently, so to speak. So the blues scale is only the black notes, which you pointed out were this, and we just add in this note here. Can you play that for me, Rob? Okay. So that is the blues scale now. So in theory, we now have all the tools that Jerry Lee Lewis had for his right hand.
That was Master of the Ivories, Chilly Gonzalez, at the piano with me back in August. And now let's go back further to February, when we witnessed an interesting shift in musical interests in Southeast Asia. In 1975, when the Khmer Rouge came to power, Cambodia's colourful music scene was diminished. Artists and musicians were targeted by the genocidal communist regime. Most died or fled the country. Now, decades later, a small group of young Cambodians are rediscovering their voices and forging something new. It's in the form of punk, metal and hardcore music, genres completely unknown by most people in this traditional society. The first EP by a Cambodian hardcore group was released at the beginning of the year, and from the capital Phnom Penh, Kyle James took a closer look at this small but burgeoning scene, and here's a snippet of his findings.
Turn on a TV set in Cambodia, and you might just go into sugar shock. The channels are chock full of syrupy sweet Cambodian pop music videos. They're extremely saccharine affairs that usually follow the same script. There's young love, adoring looks, and often a traffic accident, and then lots of weeping next to a hospital bed. And just like all those fake Louis Vuitton bags and knockoff iPhones for sale here, much of Cambodian music is copied, usually from Korea or other Asian countries, with Khmer lyrics added on. Vocalist Van Ten Hoorn can't deal with any of it.
Cambodia has lost its creativity in like a really long time, and then because people need to make money, so that's why people just like plagiarize stuff from other countries, and then so that's why I started this band, because I hate the idea of plagiarism. So yeah, I was like, why not just make our own stuff, and then something that I love to do.
What he loves to do is sing in his hardcore band, Slitten Six. Slitten Six is probably the best known of a handful of Khmer hardcore, punk, and metal bands that are treading very new ground in Cambodia these days. They met over a hardcore fan page and have no interest in playing mainstream pop. Instead, they're taking inspiration from music they found on the internet. Hardcore bands almost never make it to Cambodia on tour. Then they give the music their own spin. Van Tin, or Tin as he's better known, writes songs about contemporary Cambodian issues like meth addiction and even the Khmer Rouge. Then the 21-year-old gets in front of the mic and explodes.
It just feels great to, like, you know, do stuff that people don't really have never seen before. They're just like, what's going on? I'm just like, yeah. And most of the time I'm pretty drunk as well, so I don't really remember what it is.
Tin and his bandmates are often found at Showbox, a bar and club that's become a magnet for young Cambodian misfits in this conservative society. It's also one of the few places in town where Western expats and young Khmer people socialize. Miley Rattle runs Showbox. He came to Cambodia 2 years ago from Australia. He says he saw Slitten Six at a show in Phnom Penh and realized something new and interesting was going on. He opened his bar to be a part of it.
Music scene-wise, it's a microcosm of New York in the 60s. There's hardcore and there's punk and there's metal, and it's just uber new here.
That was our report on Cambodia's emerging punk scene, and if that's left you hankering for more, you can rock out to the full thing in episode 124. Now to a man who knows a thing or two about creativity. John Hegarty has made a name as one of the key players of British and international advertising. A super creative, you might say. BBH, the agency he co-founded in the early 1980s, made some of the defining campaigns of that golden age of advertising for the likes of Levi's, Audi and Lynx. Hegarty dropped by the studio back in March, and here's a sliver of our conversation.
Could I see your papers, please?
A lot of people say music is the greatest of all art forms. I disagree. I think it's the second greatest of all art forms. I think life is the greatest of all art forms. Therefore, we're all creative, you know. In a sense, we are creative. So it's instinctive without us realizing it. And I describe creativity as an expression of self. But you find that people say, of course, I'm not creative. Well, you are. And therefore, even as a practitioner, you're sort of using things instinctively. And when I did this, I sat down and thought, well, what would be the 50 things that I would say to somebody? Now, some are obvious, like, you know, start with an idea, don't become a cynic, juxtaposition one thing against another thing. But then as you think about it and you think about collaboration, it's a big word that we use today. We hear everybody say, oh, we must all collaborate and we're in a collaborative kind of economy and all that sort of stuff. And you go, well, to a certain extent, but great ideas come out of the mind of one person. It's driven by one person. So you've got to balance those things out. The reason actually I enjoyed doing it and I wanted to do it is that I've read so much about the creative process from people who never do it.
Yeah, right.
Who actually have ideas, who don't follow them through, who don't see success and failure with the ideas that they've had. They've not made them. They've not kind of, and yet they all write about it. This is how you do it. Sitting on a beanbag does not make you creative, let me tell you. So,
heading back to the dark days of the 90s in an ad agency, isn't it?
Right? Not at all. Go to Shoreditch right now, and okay. There are more beanbags per square foot in Shoreditch than anywhere else in the world. And everybody thinks that's what makes you creative, and it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. And of course, journalists, you know, who observe creativity always want to kind of, well, what does it look like?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's all going on in your head all the time. I mean, technology has always been a driver of creativity. How we can get a story out there, how we can tell somebody something. Technology has been a fundamental part of that. Well, in the last 10 years, we've seen 15 years, we've seen a tsunami of technology hit us. But it's affected it in certain ways, but in other ways, it still remains exactly the same. We have to tell a story. Yeah. Storytelling is fundamental to the basis of brands. And therefore, how do you get that story out? Now we have many, many more ways of doing so. So it's a very exciting time to be in, I think, in any creative industry.
That was top ad man John Hegarty. And just like everything else you hear on this show, it's still available to download from monocle.com/radio or on iTunes. And here's a hint, episode 127 for that one. Plenty more that we've enjoyed and you will enjoy, we hope, to come in the show, including some of our favourite movie moments of the year. We'll hear from Culture Club legend Boy George. We remember that weekend spent at the greenest of festivals in South Wales back in August. Plus, much, much more here on Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. But of course, as ever, we begin the second half with some music and none other than the formidable Gregory Porter. He's got enough puff in his lungs to take the roof off Midori House, and that he very nearly did. The Grammy Award-winning jazz singer swung by the studios all the way back in January to treat us to a few songs from his album Liquid Spirit. And here he is with the title track.
Reroute the river, let that damn water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free. The folk are thirsty 'cause of man's unnatural hand. Watch what happens when the people catch wind of water hitting the banks of hard dry land. Clap your hands now, come on, clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Get ready for the wave. It might strike like a final flood. The people haven't drank in so long, the water won't even make mud. After it comes, it might come with a steady flow. Grab the roots of the tree down by the river. Dip your cup when your spirit's low. Clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now, 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 now. Hey, 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 now. Dip down, take a drink, and fill your water tank. Dip down, take a drink, and fill your water tank. Get ready for the wave, might strike like the final flood. The people haven't drank in so long, the water won't even make mud. After it comes, it might come with a steady flow. Grab the roots of the tree down by the river. Dip your cup when your spirit's low. Clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now. Come on, clap your hands now.
That was Gregory Porter from our session back in episode 118. This is the best bits of culture from the past 12 months, and we now turn our attention to film. We've spoken to some big players in the film industry this year, including Jean-Pierre Jeunet, Saoirse Ronan, Stellan Skarsgård and Julian Schnabel, to name but a few. One of our favourite interviews, though, was with Oscar-winning documentary maker Errol Morris. This year saw the release of his film The Unknown Known, about the life and career of one of recent history's most infamous character, former US Defence Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The taut, fascinating and at times very funny film spends almost 2 hours trying to see behind Rumsfeld's outward show of avuncular hair splitting to the man and the motivations beneath. Here's Errol Morris on The Unknown Known.
The Unknown Known is both things that you know that you didn't think you know and things that you think you know that you don't know. Take your pick. It's that way across the board. These endless slogans, epithets, maxims, rules. I call it Donald Rumsfeld's Chinese fortune cookie philosophy.
And there does seem to be that a lot of that in there. Did you get the sense that there's a moment in the film where he says that he wasn't trying to, in inverted commas, do history with all these various tens of thousands of memoranda that he had dictated? Did you get a sense that he was trying to do history? Because he speaks in what he thinks, I guess, is an epigrammatical way, doesn't he, for example?
It really depends on what you mean. Sorry to sound like Donald Rumsfeld here. What you mean by do history.
Yeah.
I would think it's a version of obliterating history. If you write enough memos, if you create a paper tsunami, then somehow the world just vanishes.
Yeah. And is that the thing? Is it about prevarication, all these decades of what are called and what he calls snowflakes or these paper memoranda?
I would say beyond. Is that a concept, beyond prevarication?
I don't know, but it sounds like a sequel.
It does, doesn't it? Prevarication suggests that he's trying to hide something and he's lying about it. He is lying unendingly, but I don't think he's hiding anything. I think he's just in a kind of bubble universe of his own devising. It's one of the most disturbing interviews I've ever done.
That was Errol Morris on his documentary, The Unknown Known. Now, the film festival trail has taken us from Iran to Copenhagen to Edinburgh to Toronto and, of course, to the Sundance Festival in Utah this year. But one that's perhaps less reported on is DocuFest, which takes place each summer in Kosovo's historic town of Prizren. The festival celebrates documentary and short film and offers Kosovars something they've never had before, access to the worldwide stage of filmmaking. We sent Melanie Sevchenko along to find out more.
In August, Prizren gets loud. DocuFest brings the people from near and far. In its outdoor cinemas, under a canopy of stars, international guests and acclaimed filmmakers watch the big picture in the sky. In its 13th year, the festival screens a selection of more than 200 hand-picked films from around the world, across 6 competitions and in over a dozen special programs. There's also photo exhibitions, workshops, masterclasses, and concert nights. And in the lively, cobbled streets, many gather in outdoor cafes to sip a raki, or local schnapps, in the cool evening breeze, after the scorching sun has fallen behind the mountains. But it wasn't always like this. Cinema culture in Kosovo indeed experienced its share of dark days, and only recently has it started to see the light. Before the war in the late 90s, there were 35 cinema screens in total in Kosovo. 3 of them were in Prizren. Veton Nurkolari, the artistic director of DocuFest, explains what happened.
With the war and with the collapse of the whole distribution system, the cinemas collapsed. And it took a couple of years for the only cinema to restart in all of the country. And it took another 12 years for us to be able to bring cinema back to Prizren. So now all of Kosovo has actually two screens.
That's right, only two screens. That's why DokuFest has erected improvised venues in Prizren Center. There's even a cinema on the river that cuts through the town, and another in a castle on the foothills of a mountain. But even then, Kosovo is still missing a cinema-going culture. Most of the audience is not from here. Yet the festival continues its outreach. For over a decade, DokuFest has not only brought documentary cinema to Kosovo, but it's also ignited a filmmaking scene. 8 years ago, their film fund was created.
The fund itself has grown from a few hundred thousand to nearly 1 million, which is, in my opinion, again, a direct consequence of this festival and several other festivals and decision makers understanding finally that it's worth to invest in film, and which in turn, again, brought some recognition.
Melanie Sevchenko's report from DokuFest in Kosovo there. You're listening to The Best of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Up next, we pack our bags and hit the road.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're choosing some of our favourite moments from the last year. During 2014, we've picked a few topics to spend an entire hour unpicking. Also, you could find out a few things you didn't know you needed to know about. These included crosswords.
We're all nerding out about crosswords, and these crosswords in particular, which are usually the best ones, some of the best ones that we see all year.
We took a look at the art of the breakfast show.
One of the sort of common themes that we've picked out through all of the breakfast radio stations that we've been listening to from around the world is this kind of this optimism of the new day, the fresh day, you know, unsullied by the work and stress of the day before. You're open-minded, and I think a lot of the radio stations we've been listening to really tap into that.
And I even took one for the team and nervously had my scrawl analysed for a handwriting episode.
You give yourself quite a lot of obstacles in your life. I think you're impatient. I don't think you'd suffer fools gladly at all. And very versatile, very quick thinker, I would say.
Alongside all that, we've investigated comics, which saw producer Holly in a spandex-filled convention centre in East London. We twirled around the subject of Italo disco, and we spent a weekend camping in a Welsh valley, which brings me on to our next interview. Back in August, we packed up our wellies and microphones and took Culture on the road with a trip to the Green Man Festival. Now, in its 11th year, the event is held in the luscious surroundings of the Glanusk Estate and plays host for a top-notch lineup, which this year included the likes of Beirut, Mercury Rev, First Aid Kit and the War on Drugs. Whilst at the festival, we spoke to a wealth of musicians, organisers, speakers and even a surgeon named Dr. Kneebone. But one of my favourite interviews was with Pete Brown. Pete's a writer who specialises in beers and ciders, and he talked me through the highlights of the Green Man Bar.
Some festivals are catching up with what people want when they go to a festival. I think when people go to a festival, they want, whether it's beer or food or the bands that they're seeing, they want to see something they've not had before. They want to be a bit adventurous and do something they wouldn't do just at home. And you still go to some festivals where there is one big corporate, commercial, multinational, global lager brand and one big UK cider brand, and they think that people are going to be happy with that. And then you look at this tent and how packed this tent is compared to every other beer tent on site. And by the way, the beer tents on site at Green Man generally are better than the ones you get at most festivals, but this one is something else.
Maybe with a couple of the headliners at this year's Green Man, maybe you could match a headliner, you can match a band with a beer.
Yeah, well, I just did my show this morning matching the beers and bands of Green Man. One of the headliners that people seem really excited about seeing is First Aid Kit. A defining feature of that band, one of the huge sources of their appeal, is the beautiful close harmonies of the two sisters who sing their songs. It's just a wonderful sound. And to me, that harmony is sweetness. So the third beer we tried, the Summer Ale, the kind of grapefruit character, the fruity character in that, with those female harmonies, just is bliss. And that's what I'll be drinking when they're on stage.
That was writer Pete Brown speaking to us at the Green Man Festival this year. To hear the whole damn fandango, download episode 149. We're almost at the end of this show, but before we go, let's hear from one of our biggest guests of the year. He's a legend, one of the key conspirators in 20th century pop culture, one of the most famous faces to ever strike an attitude in dreads and makeup and in hats and makeup again. Boy George told us about comebacks, love, and while he'll never be the uncle in the boob tube.
Take the car. Take the flat screen, let me keep my dignity. Take it all, it's just a shallow victory.
It's been a while since I've kind of done a kind of organic album recording, so
yeah.
And I was put on the spot. I was doing an interview somewhere and I hadn't had a title for the album, and I was asked, what's it called? And I thought, well, this is what I do, you know. Yeah. Although it's not entirely true, because I do lots of different things, but more about kind of driving people towards, you know, what I do as a performer, you know, rather than kind of the things I've kind of done in my personal life.
After 18 years, then, we said 1995 is the last studio record.
Yeah.
How on earth do you decide what you want to do? How the feel and the vibe of the record is obviously something, and it has a very continuous kind of feeling of it has an easy quality to it, right?
Yeah.
How did you decide on that?
We didn't want to do anything that sounded like me trying to be current. You know, I didn't really want to sound like I was trying to fit into, you know, what's going on now, because it's a bit like your uncle kind of putting on a boob tube and sort of trying to be trying to be all trendy. Let's go partying. Yeah. I just wanted to sound... I went back, actually, to all the things that turned me on at sort of 10, 11, yeah. 12, 13. You know, the 70s, I went back to the 70s, which I always do when I'm looking for inspiration or kind of intention, sort of spirit, vibe. And so I went back to all the things, you know, and the 70s was such a bonkers decade for music, because you had, you know, glam rock, reggae, you had the Goombay Dance Band and the Sex Pistols,
yeah.
Cliff Richard, you know, and your disco, you know, it was all these sort of things that shouldn't have gone together. You know, when you watched Top of the Pops in the 70s, you never knew what was going to pop up, you know, Gary Glitter, Mrs. Mills, yeah. You know, it was bonkers. And I was so influenced by all of that, you know, when I was growing up. So whenever I'm sort of looking for inspiration, I'll always go back to those people, the Bowies, you know, Roxy Music, Mark Bolan, Joni Mitchell, Dylan, you know, Leonard Cohen, all of those kind of characters.
Now your big words mean nothing, your smile is like a curse. Oh, it's easy when you're the one who stops loving first.
It's taking a break out and coming back with this new studio LP. Obviously, there's all the DJing and all that sort of is, yeah, its own snowball, its own monster now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But is promoting stuff and doing this kind of thing, is that different to how it was 15 years ago and before that? Or is and embracing all the social media and stuff, has that changed your job promoting a record?
Actually, it feels different here because I'm doing different things. So I'm not doing everything. I'm sort of saying no to a lot of things. You know, I don't really want to do that, you know. But abroad, places like France, it just feels like they never kind of got over what I was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting that, like, places like Italy and France, they do tend to kind of be obsessed with the 80s.
Yeah.
And in fact, the other night I was in Milan and this woman came up to me and she went, "Do you really want to hurt me?" And I looked at her and I was like, "Yeah, I do, actually. Is that your opening line?" And I was like, I've done so much since that record. I mean, I love the record, don't get me wrong, but it's like, you're negating my whole life, you know. And then she just kind of carried on doing what she was doing. But there is a kind of...
What was she doing?
Oh, she was just trying to interview me about the past. You know, it's like, you know, like people say things like, "Do you miss the 80s? And I'm like, "No. What kind of sad individual would I be if I missed the 80s? I
mean, that was going to be my last question.
Oh, you was? Oh, yeah, well, I don't.
No.
I don't. But yeah, I think in certain places, you know, because I haven't been to sort of certain countries for a long time, it's like they sort of think, like, they say, "Oh, you look really different." Yeah, I cut my dreadlocks off in there, about 1987 or something. And it's just so funny. And it's like, well, yeah, I'm 52.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing what people think and what people say. And I suppose in a way, that's part of the fun of it.
Now your big words mean nothing. Your smile is like a curse. it's easy when you're the one who stops loving first.
That was Boy George, and you've been listening to a special culture show with me, Robert Bound. As I said before, if you've enjoyed any of the highlights you've heard on this show, the full versions are still available to download from monocle.com/radio or on good old iTunes. Special thanks to the team for all their efforts over the last year. Producer Holly, who stuck with me through thick, thin and thick again. Plus, of course, those best supporting males, Tom Hall and Paul Noble. But for now, to play us out of the radio and indeed into the nearest pub, is a lady who spoke with a voice so timid but sang with an almighty roar. Anna Calvi paid us a visit in February to sing from her record One Breath. And from it, here she is with Suddenly. Thanks to you all for listening this year, and stay tuned for more frolics in 2015. Thanks for tuning in.
And despair.